Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com. Today's episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one website building platform with simple drag-and-drop tools to make the business building process easy. Get 10% off your first site with code PINEAPPLE.
Full Service Radio. You're listening to Pineapple Radio on Full Service Radio, broadcasting from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Atara.
And I'm your other host, Ariel. We are the founders of Pineapple Collaborative, a community for all women who love food. And welcome to 2019. This is our first episode of the year, and we're super excited to be back in DC in our hometown at the Line Hotel. We have two special guests with us today. We have Leela and Michelle.
Hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
And they are from Teaism, which is one of our favorite restaurant cafes, tea houses here in DC. It's an institution. And they, Michelle started the business 23 years ago with her business partner, and today her daughter Leela is part of the team running things, and we're going to hear from them in just a minute. But the first part of our show today, we're doing something a little bit different, which is exciting for us, given that last year we did, I think, almost 25 episodes, learned a ton. And this year, we're hoping to share with you ideas that really resonate with me and Atara, the Pineapple team, and the Pineapple community as a whole. We're always seeking to build a better business, as we say, internally. And that looks like a lot of things for ourselves as founders and supporting each other, for our team, for our customers, for our community, and for you. And so one of these ideas that we've been thinking a lot about last year and also really want to focus on this year is the concept of the feminist business.
Yeah. And to add to what Ariel is saying, you know, the idea of a feminist business is something we think about all the time when we are running the show, and we really couldn't do what we do without our partners. And one of those partners that makes it possible is Squarespace. Squarespace is in this with us, and they are supporting us in being a better business. They are the ones who are helping us produce these radio shows, bring events and other digital content to the fold, and we are very grateful for their support.
So normally we give like a short tidbit of better business advice, but actually this whole first part of the episode is our better business advice for today.
And it's meaty.
And it's meaty. So the creator of the feminist business philosophy and the corresponding principles is a woman named Jen Armbrust, and her company is called Sister. We're going to reference her company link as well as these 12 principles in the radio bio of this episode. So definitely check it out. But we are incredibly inspired by all of her writings. She sends, you know, almost weekly emails, and she has a book she just published, which you should definitely check out. And so the following is a number of different excerpts that we've pieced together that she wrote that are really guiding us in the new year. So I'm going to start us off, and Atara and I are going to, you know, collaborate and switch off. So here we go. So as entrepreneurs and individuals, we have the opportunity to agitate the current social, political, and economic order by experimenting with new business models that honor our values, our humanity, and the earth.
And feminism requires that we, as entrepreneurs and individuals, develop our critical consciousness and that we engage with questions of sexism, exploitation, racism, classism, elitism, and accessibility. It's about how we circulate money, treat others, treat ourselves, and treat the earth. And we do that first by identifying places that we are complicit in perpetuating these forms of oppression. In a real way, a feminist business is a site to embody new values, create new economies, and experiment with new distributions of power.
Yes, it's all about redistributing power and resources based on feminine principles, which we'll go through in just a few minutes. But it's about radical social transformation. It's about progress and making the world we want to live in. It's our job in this moment, in 2019, not to dream anew, but to tell the truth of the world we want to live in, and to channel these newly available energies into the cultivation of those systems. It's clear every day that the old rules weren't guidelines for harmonious living at all, but rather just another form of social control to be bent at whim by those with the power to write them. As we face a collapse of courage and leadership in our country, we can stop looking up for someone to step in and save us. As June Jordan, the Caribbean American poet, essayist, and activist said, "We are the ones we've been waiting for."
I just got the chills. It's so powerful. And Jen mentions that the first step in dismantling oppression and capitalism is addressing what's not working now in our current order in business. The status quo in business promotes income inequality, the demise of democracy, the depletion of our planet, overworking, under-earning, playing it small by being apolitical, and unquestioningly adopting others' business practices.
So what is working? Cultivating a healthy relationship with our business, prioritizing the needs of our bodies, reimagining the 40-hour work week, and working with others to create something bigger than ourselves. Atara and I have every intention of using this year to dive deep into the importance of using our voices and being political, consciously making business choices in alignment with our values, reconfiguring our workspace to be more body loving, adopting a work week that allows us to do what we love, and working with you to do so much more.
So what we want to do now is go into the core tenets of what it means to be a feminist business. Jen basically has a manifesto that we're going to read to you because we find it so powerful in how we make decisions in our business.
So keep in mind as we read these that a feminist business is a practice, not a destination.
All right. A framework for the practical application of the tenets of the feminine economy. Here's the first one. You have a body. Create structures that support and nourish your body and all other bodies you know.
Two, you are connected with the earth, the plants, and all living beings. Cultivate loving, healthy relationships with plants, animals, people, and the earth. Commune, think about our shared future.
Number three, integrate. Gather all your parts. Reclaim the pieces you have lost or forgotten. Forgive yourself. Come home to your body. Own your skills, talents, and abilities. Step into wholeness.
Four, institutionalize empathy. Build frameworks that support feelings. As we learn to empathize with ourselves, we naturally begin to empathize with others. Attunement to feelings guides us to the fulfillment of needs. The regular fulfillment of needs is the foundation of a sustainable life.
Five, embody your values. Cultivate your inner authority. Act with intention. Innovate new business practices rooted in your principles. Making choices in alignment with your values is the root of healthy self-esteem. Thriving economically while living your values is deeply disruptive to the current social and economic order.
Six, reclaim happiness. New definitions of success. Release the life you were told you would, could, or should have, and imagine anew. Seek happiness, pleasure, and the fulfillment of your needs. Move towards the things that bring you nourishment and joy.
Seven, a quote by Sister Coretta Kent. Consider everything an experiment. Do not wait until you know to act. Anything you don't know, you will learn in the process. Improvise, iterate, ask questions, ask more questions, explore. Give yourself permission to not know and to make mistakes. Find freedom in uncertainty. Be receptive and responsive instead of predictive and protective.
Eight, free yourself from the myth of the meritocracy. There is no earning. There's no deserving. There's no reward. Divest your ego of the want to prove itself through struggle, sacrifice, and hard work. Become attuned to your needs and honor them as they arise. Feel into your body. Let inner wisdom be your guide. Go where you are called. Eat when you are hungry. Rest when you are tired.
9. Tell the truth. We are being so thoroughly lied to, it's an epidemic. Say how you're feeling. Admit when you don't know. Speak your truth. Repudiate lies, deceptions, and misrepresentations. Hold yourselves and others accountable. Own your talents and abilities. Advocate for the people and the things you believe in. Use your voice.
10. Cultivate abundance consciousness. Feel your deep connection with the earth. Nature is abundance embodied. Scarcity teaches us gratitude and responsibility. Be grateful. Remember, wealth has nothing to do with money. Practice radical self-love. Nourish, nurture, savor. Feel how rich you are already.
11. A business can be a healing for yourself and others. Everything that you are needing, someone else is needing too. Everything you are healing for yourself, you are healing for someone else too. Make your business a medicine, a salve.
And 12. A business can be a model for a new social and economic order.
Awesome. So we want to take a few minutes. That was, you know, extremely powerful. And even reading it again, it is endlessly inspiring. But we wanted to talk about how we're putting those ideas into practice at Pineapple. And I think that we're really trying to zero in and work on all of those areas and tenets every day as a practice, not a destination, like Ariel said. But the three that we wanted to highlight are first, institutionalizing empathy. One thing that we're doing as a really practical way in order to make space for our feelings and to say that our feelings are valid and it's okay to feel them is to make time for our team to talk to us. One thing that we have tried doing for our team members at Pineapple is basically making office hours for them to talk to us and to really set the stage and tell them that anything that they're feeling, if it's, you know, if they're feeling challenged in some way, that it's okay and that we need to talk about it. And that space is a safe place for them to decompress.
The second is cultivating abundance, you know, redefining wealth. When you're starting up a business for the first time, money isn't per se the biggest form of success. And for us, we think about meeting other women and learning their stories and, you know, sharing their knowledge, their experience with our community of, you know, thousands of women across the country as a form of success. And when I was reflecting on 2018, thinking about, you know, our first full year in business, you know, one of the things that I was most proud of was, you know, being able to interview one of my lifelong heroes on here on Pineapple Radio. And I was like, that is a form of success that money could never buy.
Yeah. And then lastly is business as a model for new social and economic order. So thinking about the resources that you do have, whether it's, you know, in Pineapple's case, it's access to a large community and a source for media, and thinking about who we're representing there, thinking about how we have a platform and the power to tell the stories of marginalized voices and how that is a inherently disruptive action that has a lot of power.
So that's the section on the feminist business. I'm sure we could talk about it so much more and hope to have further conversations with you, the Pineapple community, you know, over the course of this year. Again, these were principles and passages that were written by Jen Armbrust of the company Sister. Her company's link will be in our bio. And thank you to Squarespace for helping us build a better business. We're going to take a break before we head into the second part of our episode, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
you're listening to is produced by Morris. The song is called Breakfast at Richmond's. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Pineapple Radio. I'm your host, Atara, and we are here today with Michelle and Leela of one of our all-time favorite restaurants in D.C., Teaism. Hi.
Hi.
So Teaism is one of our favorite restaurants, like I just mentioned, in D.C. We're big home cooks, but when we need a nutritious and delicious meal out, Teaism is the spot and has been for decades. If you're not familiar, Teaism is a collection of Asian-inspired tea houses that infuse the culture of tea and the ideals of Teaism with the informality and casualness of America.
So Michelle, who's here with us in the studio, started this business with her partner, her business partner, Linda Newman, back in 1996. With business philosophies, operations, and values that we think were ahead of their time and still are to a large extent. They pioneered the, you know, fast casual format before fast casual was a buzzword. They source so many of their ingredients locally, transparently, organically, and they introduced the concept of food waste on their menu before it was super buzzy. And overall, you know, when you eat there, when you experience the hospitality, you feel how the business is run with true intention and a dedication to a global community and the environment. So very much in line with the feminist business philosophy that we just shared with you in the first half of the episode.
So we're going to go right into our interview, if y'all are okay with that. So we're going to first talk about the idea of an intentional business. Your business has been around for 23 years. Tell us about why you started the business and what you've learned over the years.
Well, it started out as a tea business. It is ultimately a restaurant, but it just seemed like it was time for tea. Coffee houses had been around, you know, maybe for about maybe 5 or 10 years, already going strong. And I remember asking a friend, saying, I think I'd like to open a tea place. And she said, well, you told me 10 years ago you wanted to open a coffee house. And I laughed at you, you know, because I had taken that first trip to Italy and seen the coffee, you know, scene there and thought, oh, this should be in America. And then it was. So it just seemed like it was time. There were Wall Street Journal articles about chai and things going on in California, in the West Coast, and not really anything here. So it just made sense.
And did you grow up enjoying tea in your family home?
Not at all. You know, Lipton, maybe, iced tea. But I was married to an Indian gentleman, Leela's father, and I had to make chai 5 times a day for him. So I got really good at it. And when we split, it was just like this big absence. It was what happened. I tried to drink coffee. I couldn't. I drank it for like 6 months and immediately went right back to tea. And I said, you know, there's something to this. And started asking friends, you know, do you drink tea? When do you drink tea? A lot of people would say, oh, I drink tea when I'm sick, but only when I'm sick. So the other part of this is that space that you guys enjoy so much, DuPont Circle. When Linda and I started looking for space, our broker brought us that space, and we're like, it's too small. It's too small to be a restaurant. What can it be? It could be a tea house. You know, so we started our research right away, kind of based on that location theme of this is a great location and what's needed here. And it is right next to a Starbucks. Mm-hmm. So it just made sense.
You made a nice counterpoint.
So, Michelle, I remember when we were chatting before this episode, you were sharing that when you open your doors in DuPont Circle, the response from the community here in D.C. Was totally different than you anticipated.
Yeah, it was quite overwhelming. We were just busy from the get-go. And on the weekends, on Saturdays, we would do maybe 600 people through there on a Saturday. People were sitting on the stairs, you know, sitting outside. It was crazy. There were just moments where I'd be like, can we just lock the door? I mean, what are we going to do here? But it was really amazing to see the response. And
you were saying that, like, you know, folks from Japan, India, like, yeah, from the embassies, like, they were coming and, like, relishing the fact that there was now a tea house in D.C.
Yeah. The DuPont Circle brings such diversity. And I had been working in fine dining prior, and it just opened up D.C. for me. You know, I had no idea the diversity that D.C. offered. And you would see women in saris sitting in the corner, you know, tourists. Like, the Teaism banner is a beacon to global travelers, not to Americans. To Americans, they're what is that? I don't understand. Let's go somewhere else. But to international travelers, you know, they're so happy to see the respite that is a tea house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what does a tea house or teaism mean to you?
You know, for me, it's a safe place. It was always about creating a safe place, whether that was for our customers, so that they could come in and enjoy tea many times a day. A safe place for our staff, where they could feel safe. And the calm that tea brings, you know. And we were in such chaos many days, you know, but food writers would write about the calm and the tranquil space. And we were a little shocked about that.
I think that also speaks to sort of what you were saying in the list of feminist business principles, the whole question of accessibility. And, you know, tea and having that moment of rest is so important, especially now. But having the space to really have that calm and have it be accessible, I think, is really important. Because right now, tea, I think, is still thought of in these sort of stuffy afternoon tea format type of way. And I think part of our mission, at the very least, is to make it more accessible to everybody.
Definitely. And how have you seen the DC restaurant scene change over the past 23 years? Obviously, it's changed tremendously, but how has that looked from TSM's perspective?
Wow. I think that the evolution of focusing on food and focusing on serving healthy meals and sourcing carefully, you know, that maybe has it began with restaurants, and I think now that we're at the other end of the spectrum here, that it hit a tipping point, and now we have demand coming to us where our customers are saying, I want this, I don't want to eat soy, I want, you know, gluten-free meals, I don't want to eat so much meat, you know, so it's been really quite an amazingly fast evolution to see how things have changed. And I'm guessing that the internet and technology have really fueled this aspect of where we are. I feel a little bit sometimes like we're on a treadmill just running to keep up, you know, because now things are just happening so quickly. Mm. Yeah.
I would say, I think that that's part of, like, the good side of it, you know, that now I think there's a lot more appreciation for eating local, eating fresh. You know, we have a fresh farms market practically all over the city, all over the DMV area, and I think that's a really sort of, you know, positive way the DC food landscape has changed, and chefs making sure they're sourcing regionally and all that. That's just been, I mean, even a national trend, right? I think maybe some of the downside has a little bit to do with the sort of development boom we have been seeing in DC has meant that there's so many more restaurants everywhere, and it's made for some really tough competition. I can't imagine a single restaurant owner in the city would say otherwise. You know, so and that also probably really ties in with, you know, the downfall of independent retailers, right? There's no, retailers don't want these spaces, so now developers are shopping out to, you know, another restaurant concept. So how many can we have, and how many can we support, and what is that going to look like in the future? I don't really know. It's a big question.
Definitely. But what I find time and again, you know, why I keep going back to teaism is that despite this restaurant boom, you know, there are a few places that are casually serving nutrient dense, well-sourced food. And so when you want something that's like simple, healthy, nourishing, delicious, it's like, well, I can cook at home, maybe go to Sweet Green or go to teism.
Those are the options. Yeah.
That's my calculus. But Lila, you have grown up in this restaurant. I remember you were sharing that you were like in middle school and, you know, helping out, you know, on winter break. And now you're, you know, running retail management throughout your stores and the social media, and, you know, bringing a fresh, or I should say new perspective, new generational perspective to the business. So tell us about how you've seen it evolve over the years.
I mean, I think as a business as a whole, it's hard to say I can see the whole evolution, because to me, I remember the continuity. And there's so many of our regular customers that actually remember me from when I was a little kid. So because you're there every day, it's kind of hard for me to zoom out that far and say this is how teaism specifically has changed. I could talk to you for ages about how our menu has changed and our mission concept, and I'm sure we'll get into that, but you know, that's a little bit of a hard question. But just for me, being of a younger generation and working and looking at food, I think what most frustrates me is that the restaurant industry and food industry on the whole, there are certain things that you can and can't say, and there's gaps in communication and the way that we communicate people. And I think that goes back to also part of this feminist principles that you're talking about of speak your truth. And, you know, speaking openly about the food system and, you know, what we want to do and what we think we're doing well, what we think we could be doing better, and doing it in a frank and open way, I think is kind of the way that we need to go. And it's really hard because there's such a pull in the opposite direction that, you know, we could put something out and say something, but what if it makes us look bad in X, Y, or Z way? And
it's still the service industry.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And people are always going to project whatever they want onto the business that they're going to. You know, as the social media manager, I saw someone posted a picture of our chocolate salty oat cookies that we bake with the woman who developed the recipe. Her name is Terry Horn, and she has a company called Kayak Cookies, and we bake them for her here in D.C. There's a chocolate salty oat cookie that's very popular in D.C.
So good.
And this woman posted it. She, like, was, like, vegan and gluten-free and all of these things that she just, like, projected onto the cookie, you know? And so then we're like, well, what do we do about that, you know?
Because
they're
the
not
truth.
Vegan. Okay, got it.
It's none of those things. But, right. You know, people have this idea of who we are. And you know, yeah, I whenever I have the opportunity to interact with any customer, my approach, I think I've maybe inherited this from my mom, but my approach maybe a little also generationally is to be as transparent and open as possible. Like, people are like, why is this not happening? I'm like, well, we're out of it. You know, why?
Yeah.
I'm not going to, you know, make up some story that's not true.
Well, transparency is very radical, especially in the food system, because things aren't perfect. And to your point, you know, your customers have a perception of teaism, and it's not always going to be the exact, you know, expectation that they have in their minds. But Lila, you mentioned or you referenced the mission, the concept, and how that's evolved. Can you take us through that?
Yeah.
That process?
Yeah. So I mean, I would say, and I know that early on when teaism started out, the focus was always on healthy and wholesome food. But I, while growing up with my mom, have managed to watch her journey with her relationship to food and her sort of drive to implement what she was learning about the food and the food system and our food in general into our menu. So, you know, maybe around, I think, 2003, 2004, I remember coming home from school and she'd be like, these trans fats and this high fructose corn syrup, it's everywhere, and these additives, and I'm really concerned about it. And it's because she was learning and reading about that at the time. And so we made an effort, you know, around that time to completely cut out any trans fats or additives that she was finding, you know, in our supply chain. So that was sort of like, I think, a sort of beginning step. And then, you know, a little bit later, around 2008 to 2010, all of a sudden I'd come home and my mom would be like, these GMOs and this pesticides and they're doing things to our bodies, and I gotta get everything from Fresh Farms and organic. And, you know, it was just within our own household, that approach to food was something that was evolving. So, you know, the logical extension of that is to also make sure that our menu is something that we would want to eat and we would want to serve people, and the people that we care about and our customers that we care about should be eating clean as well. And so, you know, not from a necessarily like ethical question of like, should plants be engineered or not, but from a standpoint of concern over how much pesticides are we ingesting, and then what do GMOs have as implications for our, you know, future biodiversity in the food system, that was of concern to her. So around then we started, you know, calling up, you know, our food suppliers and a number of, you know, produce suppliers. They didn't even know what we were talking about when we were asking them, do you have GMOs? Or what of the produce that you're sending us is a GMO or isn't? And so that was something that we have been on this sort of journey trying to, you know, undo. And now I think if you go into our restaurants, there's a dietary chart, and I'm pretty sure there's a column that says what, as far as we're able to tell and ascertain, if something has GMOs in it or not. And you can, you know, it's there with your, you know, gluten allergy or shellfish or any other dietary concern. So we're trying to sort of, you know, make sure that we're being as transparent as we possibly can be about that, and also educate people about that. And then from there, I mean, it has continued to evolve, right? So around 2014, my mom read Dan Barber's The Third Plate, mm-hmm. and I would come home and she'd be like, this book, and we're talking about it. And so out of concern about food waste and some of those issues that he started to address, we put in a section of our menu that basically was food that otherwise would have gone to waste that we were repurposing into something else, and just to sort of draw attention to it. And then from there, we've had a lot of fun in the last couple of years. You know, the DC Food Recovery Working Group has become increasingly active. They've been organizing some really, really cool events all over the city, so it's been really fun for us to watch them and their audience grow and participate in their events. You know, so it's an evolving process, and I think that aspect of working on the menu is probably the most fun, because you can see the tangible improvements and you can think ahead about what's next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for sharing that timeline.
I thought it was long.
No, it's great. Very because cool. If you look at kind of recent food history, you're highlighting a lot of the issues that have come to play and that we as eaters, we as business owners care about. And it, you know, reminds me of one of the principles of the feminist business, which is you are connected with the earth, the plants, and all living beings, and that your business is also, as you're seeking solutions for healing yourself, like you are healing others. And what you, Michelle, said at the beginning of the episode, which is people still think of restaurants as the service industry. At Pineapple, and I think increasingly more consumers are thinking about restaurants and other food businesses, not just as the service industry, but truly a nexus of all the issues we care about. You know, whether it is food and its connection to the environment and climate change, food waste, immigration issues, social justice, equality, this is the power of food, and this is why we are here today. So new ideas of restaurants, and I think you guys have thought about that for so much of your business. And back in 2012, you hosted your first, I think, event series, right? and it was before Food Tank came to DC, certainly before Pineapple started, and 100%, you know, mobilizing this community of people who care about food in DC and beyond. So tell us about that event series.
Well, Chefs as Catalyst for Change was a forum for chefs. Our chef had done so much work on sourcing and finding, you know, clean product and really working with our wholesalers to bring product to bear so that we could buy product. We would literally have to find other restaurants and sell it to them for our vendors to even carry them. You know, Blue Circle Fish, we had to find other restaurants that would sell it so that we could buy it. The organic chicken, the Shenandoah Valley organic chicken, you know, the vendor was happy to sell it, but we needed more than one restaurant buying it.
Now that's why Glenn's Market carries it, which is kind of fun and cool.
Yes, and Mom's has it now, and you know, so Chefs as Catalyst for Change was developed to kind of share what we had learned with other chefs and to try to build the community. Now, prying chefs out of kitchens is a really hard thing to do. But we wanted them to have a place that they could come to on a Monday afternoon, usually their day off, drink some beer, have a little food, nothing too, you know, complicated, and listen to people talk about whether it was food policy or farming. Spike Jerde has actually spoken twice at our events and with such amazing passion. He's my hero in the food world. He's doing the real thing. So we were just trying to expose more and more chefs to kind of new ideas and new ways to look at food and give them data and information. So we did that for 4 years. And
I think it was also important that the events were free, and we wanted people to come and just have it be this accessible, sort of non-intimidating thing. You know, it sort of came out of, I'd have these conversations with my mom. She'd be like, you know, man, DC restaurant community and chefs were always asked to do these events. You know, you got to be there for Chefs for Equality. You got to be there for Zufar. And all of that is great and wonderful, but it means you just throughout the year are kind of running yourself ragged. And when do we take the time as a community to sit and really reflect and think on what we want to do next and maybe even air your dirty laundry and say, man, I really wish I was sourcing this better. How are you doing it? Where has it become complicated for you? And talk through those things. That was kind of the motivation behind the event. And it was Food Day who approached us. That's a wing of, I guess it was...
the Center for Science and Public Interest.
Yeah, and then they ended, but I feel like it started back up. Or...
Well, they closed down Food Day because there became an International Food Day, which was a different day.
Right. So we were coordinating that sort of with them. So we had a really cool, you know, sort of rotating group of people that were on a planning committee with us, and we would all just get together and think through, you know, what issues do we want to get people together and talk about. And I really wish it had taken off more because I before working full-time at Teaism, was working in nonprofits out of college. So this is the sort of thing, like, you could dedicate a whole nonprofit to doing exactly that. And I think that seems to be what, you know, Food Tank and other organizations have sort of taken up that mantle. But it's a lot of work to get people even in the door. You know, I think the biggest turnout we ever had was maybe 120 people for a little conference. And it was never always all chefs. It was people from all aspects of either people who are passionate about food or, you know, other aspects of the hospitality industry as well.
Yeah. I mean, here again, this reminds me of the feminist business economy. I mean, y'all could have easily, you know, used all of the institutional knowledge that you have about sourcing as a competitive advantage, but you decided to disrupt the social order and share those best practices. And I think that that is a very powerful decision.
Well, thank you.
I really think it's amazing. But so on the question of sourcing specifically, can you tell us a little bit about your philosophy on sourcing tea? I mean, at Pineapple, we always talk about if you care about your kale, you should care about your wine or coffee or tea. So tell us about how the sourcing specifically evolved and what your ethos is.
So on the larger picture was to represent pure teas, not blended or scented. There are thousands and thousands of kinds of tea. So at the get-go, we had to narrow down our focus. And so we say that if you drink with us, you can drink anywhere in the world. If you drink mango, banana, pineapple, you know, black tea and, you know, Kool-Aid over here all day long, then you're really not going to be able to drink anywhere else in the world. So that was sort of the goal, and to really represent the elegance of the leaf itself, you know, tea. As the tea plant, the Camellia sinensis, that plant. So we've done that. And then, of course, we've had to round out with herbal blends because people really don't want to ingest caffeine after about 8 o'clock at night. So the herbal blends just, you know, have evolved over time as a companion to the tea. Yeah. Tea drinking, even I end up, you know, drinking a little soba cha sometimes because I've had just about enough black tea. But in terms of the quality of the sourcing, we find that a lot of our tea is organic, but organics is very new to the tea industry. This is an industry that's centuries old. You know, what I've noticed in the 23 years is that in the very beginning, it was America. We were pushing the tea farmers in China and in India to use pesticides. And so we forced our chemicals on them, and now we're telling them, oh, we don't want to buy that tea, we want to buy organic tea, you know. So,
and it better be certified.
That's a super interesting paradigm that we find ourselves in now.
Yeah, and it's shameful, but it is what has happened. So tea itself is sort of a natural repellent to bugs. So it doesn't really demand a lot of pesticides unless it's harvested sort of towards the end of the season, end of the growing season. So we pay attention to all of that. And the domestic distributors that we use in the U.S. are testing, you know, testing in country, testing when it gets here. So we're working with very reputable firms. And as well, there is some product that we get directly. Some stuff you just can't find domestically available that's good.
Have you been able to visit any of the farms that you source from?
Not personally, no, because we have restaurants.
Yeah, no, I can imagine.
Yeah, if we weren't in the restaurant business, we probably would not still be in the tea business. So that's
catch 22.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I am actually really hopeful that maybe this year we can make some trips happen. That's on the horizon. That's part
Very
of the
cool.
2019 hopes.
Goals.
Yeah. Goals.
So I think despite tea being more prevalent and I think tea culture becoming increasingly popular, there's still a lot of confusion around tea. Like, what tea should I drink? How do I brew it? How do I enjoy it? Where does it come from? Like, all of these questions around tea. So can you tell us a little bit about how to think about purchasing tea and then how to think about brewing different teas?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would say as far as thinking about purchasing and you were kind of wondering about maybe more like the health benefits and those aspects.
Health benefits or more just like where does it come from? Like, am I looking for organic tea? Am I looking for direct trade tea? Am I looking for single estate tea?
I would say honestly, like, if you're finding tea that you enjoy and you want to drink it regularly and it hits the, you know, price point that you want to hit, then that's great. We recommend obviously drinking the higher end loose leaf, you know, if it can be sourced directly in any way, that's great. But we work with, you know, like importers that have a long history of working with specific farmers. You know, the farm to table model that we have come to really be championing in this country in terms of food, and that's kind of what we've been moving towards in terms of food. It doesn't quite apply with tea because oftentimes, say, the tea farmer is growing beautiful leaf, but then what about the romance of how the tea leaf is being processed and you know, stopping, say, the oxidation process with a really beautiful oolong or something like that. That might have to do with, you know, the roaster or the person processing. So the tea industry as a whole, I think, is a little bit more complicated, and it does confuse, I think, a lot of people. But as long as I think you're drinking a higher quality loose leaf, not bagged tea, you're probably already in a pretty darn good place. And then, you know, from there, it's just, you were talking about like brewing. So we usually recommend, just as a good sort of heuristic to start from, a teaspoon of tea per 8 ounces of hot water. And then, you know, try brewing for maybe about 2 to 3 minutes. And from there, you can see, you know, did I like this? Was it too strong? And adjust accordingly. But, you know, green teas are going to be much more sensitive to hot water. You should use slightly cooler water.
And that basically affects the bitterness of the tea?
It does. It scalds the leaf so it becomes bitter. And then people say, I don't like green tea. And it's like, well, you probably didn't have good green tea, or if it wasn't brewed properly, then that's an issue.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. I have a question about, you know, Ariel and I have been really impressed by the intentionality behind teaism, that, you know, there's so much thought behind the sourcing, the nutrition, the teas and all of your purveyors. But what do you think about like the kind of industrialization of like artisanal teas, like thinking about like Teavana and some of those chains?
Well, they don't work.
Tell me more about that.
I mean, I don't know why. I don't know if it's just such a narrow marketplace, or that they don't encourage people to develop a habit, a tea drinking habit. I think that you need to find your way with that. And I think when you go into those places, the employees are taught you must sell a pound before you stop selling, and, you know, to each person. And, you know, they've got marketing goals instead of,
and
you know,
sales goals to meet.
Sales goals, yeah, to meet, instead of, you know, actually helping that person find what it is that will nurture them. And so that's kind of what we try to do in the tea shop, is to really work with people. A lot of people think that the tea that they must drink, I must drink tea because it's healthy, and I must drink green tea. And we say, drink whatever tea it is that you're going to drink, you know, because if you don't like green tea, it's going to sit in the cabinet, you know. So we really, really encourage people to, you know, drink what you like.
And buy in smaller quantities so that you can shop around and see what you actually like.
Yeah. We are very lucky to be placed in the market where we are, because we're big enough to turn over a relatively high volume of tea through our wholesale business to restaurants, through our mail order business, in our own restaurants making tea, brewed tea, and in our retail businesses of selling loose leaf tea to people to take home to make. So we turn over a volume of tea that not too many tea houses can do. And so we're very lucky that we're constantly bringing in fresh tea. Mm-hmm. And we've kept our focus very tight and narrow, you know, so that people will know what to expect from us. You know, it's not the next thing that has popcorn in it, or it's not the next thing that has, you know, some flowers in it.
Like respecting the leaf, the tea leaf itself, instead of
respecting the culture of it. You know, it's been very interesting, this whole thing about matcha. Everybody's crazy about matcha, and we love it. But it historically, it was for special occasions. It was a highly ritualized process to make it, and
It was medicine.
It was humbling.
It's a ceremony. Yeah.
It was the ceremony. So now America wants to put it in everything. You know, it's in the baked goods. It's in, we put it in beer. You know, I mean, now it's in everything. And when matcha first started to grab a hold of America, I thought, oh, this is horrible. This is terrible for matcha. This is so disrespectful. But Japan comes to us and Japan tells us, no, we want people to drink it and we don't care what they do with it. And so that's been a big, like, release and a relief for us, because now we can encourage people to do whatever they want to with it. But
with
this
a
is
grounding
just,
in the traditions as
yeah,
well.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, so we try to stay grounded and we try to sell the matcha bowl and the whisk and explain the process and everything. But, you know, times are changing. Things move very fast.
They do. And tea certainly moving with it. I've seen like Bon Appetit, I think it was last year or the year before, right? Like the year of tea. And highlighting some really incredible other women-owned businesses in the tea business, like Bullock in Brooklyn or Leaves and Flowers in Berkeley. And I think they each have their own sourcing philosophies. And as a consumer, it's exciting. And certainly to your point about tea culture, it is about celebrating and acknowledging cultures outside of your own, perhaps. And I just spent 10 days in Morocco, and mint tea is a ritual. Yeah. We enjoyed it, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and in between. And my boyfriend and I said to each other, like, wow, like, we just, like, never drink tea at home, or we do it when it's, like, really cold, and, like, we need something to relax or warm us up. And it made me, in addition to knowing we were going to have this episode, really think about, like, how can I bring more tea culture into my life, because it is really enjoyable in so many different ways. There's a kind of enigma to tea that I think makes it so exciting, almost like wine.
It's a tea ecosystem.
All right, on with the puns. Strong start for 2019.
Oh, yes.
Well, before we wrap up our conversation, the last question we wanted to ask you two is about the mother-daughter working relationship. We've been really lucky here at Pineapple to feature some other mother-daughter working duos like Tessa and Teresa Velasquez of Baked and Wired, Simone Jacobson and Jocelyn Layon of Tolly Moly. And my mom even advises Pineapple on the regular, so I'm aware of that dynamic. But can you all tell us, you know, what it's like to work together and how your two generational perspectives contribute to making a better business?
Sure.
I can tell you right off the front that what Leela does for me is she corrects me when I'm corny, when I say corny things. And she stops me from being too outspoken.
And yeah. Leela?
Well, I mean, I would say my mom is kind of a powerhouse unto herself, so I oftentimes feel like maybe I'm being a slacker, or I'm not doing enough for her or helping her in the right ways. But I think that I probably have more of a tendency to, you know, work with technology. I, you know, want to help put our business out there in different ways. And so as a result, she has a lot of energy, and I tend to be maybe a little bit more meticulous about, I want to follow up on this. I want to make a list about this. I want to, you know, think through this and this. So I think we have a nice balance in that way. And it's been really nice for me to get a little bit away from the everyday operations of the restaurant and be working more in the shop and on the retail end, because it allows me to also follow up so that we can do things like this. So I feel like that's kind of been what my contribution is. And she's, you know, patient with me. I'm a severely dysfunctional person in the morning, and I know it's not going to get me fired. Hasn't gotten me fired yet.
Everyone has their own internal rhythm.
Yeah.
But we have to say that we're so impressed with each of you and the business you've built. It really inspires us so much, and you really have created a legacy here in D.C. Before we close out, can you tell our audience how they can reach you, whether it's at one of your stores or online?
Sure. Well, if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, I am always in the Teaism Tea Shop in Penn Quarter, which is on 8th and D Street, just two doors up from the restaurant. Otherwise, if you wanted to reach out, you could go to www.teaism.com. Our Instagram handle is teaism, T-E-A-I-S-M underscore D-C. And yeah, we're here. We're here in the city. So we try to be available.
Grab a salty oat when you're here.
They're right. So good. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
If you're in D.C., please visit Teaism. And to close out the show, we wanted to first, again, thank Squarespace for allowing us the platform to talk about these issues, to talk about a feminist business, and to talk to Michelle and Leela of Teaism. And we're reminded that a business is not something you do alone. A business is an ecosystem. And if we are to create a business founded on purpose, pleasure, abundance, and ease, we have to work together. Ecosystems never exist or thrive as a singular organism. They succeed because of interdependency. So Ariel and I wanted to leave you with a few questions to ask yourself and to meditate on as you think about a feminist business economy and what we can all do together.
And again, these are from Jen Armbrust of Sister.
Yes. What would it feel like to be deeply supported by your business? How would it feel if your business were able to support others and create healthy, sustainable jobs? How would you feel if your business contributed meaningfully to the health of our larger ecosystems, our community, our country, and our world? Thank you so much for joining us. This is Pineapple Radio, and we'll see you next time.